Au fur et à mesure, on a agrandi un peu. Et puis maintenant, Isis consiste à 12 femmes réparties sur les deux bureaux, donc à Rome et Genève. Et puis il se trouve qu'il y a 6 femmes ici et 6 femmes à Rome. En principe, on est donc un centre de documentation sur les mouvements des femmes au niveau international. Donc notre but, c'est de collectionner des informations de partout dans le monde, de les stocker et de les diffuser aussi largement possible dans le monde. Et on fait ça de différentes manières. Donc d'abord avec notre publication trimestrielle en anglais et espagnol, qui d'habitude rassemble documents de différentes parties du monde sur un thème spécifique, comme les femmes migrantes, par exemple, la santé, la violence contre les femmes, etc. Ensuite, on diffuse beaucoup d'informations par le courrier, simplement parce qu'on a beaucoup de demandes de partout. On envoie des lettres, on envoie des bibliographies, etc. Puisque notre but est l'échange, surtout d'informations, d'expériences des femmes dans ce qu'elles vivent et dans ce qu'elles vivent et dans ce qu'elles font dans le monde. Le programme pour lequel vous êtes venu aujourd'hui n'est pas du tout étonnant. C'est-à-dire que c'est plus un échange vraiment d'informations en papier, mais en personne. Alors, l'idée est née il y a plus qu'une année, une année et demie maintenant. Un peu par hasard, en fait, c'est une des personnes qui travaille à Isis, Vals Verghese, qui elle-même est venue à Isis en tant que stagiaire, payée par un autre programme. Et c'était dans le courant de ce programme, surtout quand elle a été à une réunion de ce programme, qu'elle s'est rendue compte qu'en fait, il y avait peu de possibilités pour les femmes en tant que femmes de faire un échange, d'aller dans une autre culture et de vivre ce que les femmes font dans cette culture. Alors c'est comme ça que l'idée est née. Et on a fait toutes les démarches et puis maintenant on est très heureuse en fait d'accueillir 12 femmes en tout. En fait il y a seulement 10 maintenant, il y en a 2 qui arriveront plus tard. Qui viennent de partout dans le monde, je crois qu'il y a 8 pays en tout qui sont concernés. Qui sont donc à Genève pendant 2 semaines pour un cours d'orientation à Isis et qui partiront après ce week-end dans d'autres pays. De nouveau, je crois qu'il y a 7 ou 8 pays différents. Alors, chaque femme travaille dans un domaine spécifique aux femmes, donc par exemple les centres de, je ne sais jamais comment on dit, les rape crisis centers, ou bien dans la santé, ou bien dans la communication, les publications pour femmes. Et chaque femme donc va aller travailler dans un groupe, dans un autre pays, qui traite un peu du même sujet. Par exemple, je prends simplement un exemple, Edith de Hong Kong, qui travaille dans le Hong Kong Council of Women, surtout sur le viol, va travailler à Tel Aviv, en Israël, dans le Rape Crisis Center, donc le centre contre le viol, à Tel Aviv, en Israël. Ça, c'est pour donner un exemple. Et puis, il y a la feuille jaune, donc, qu'on peut passer. Là, vous avez toutes les participantes, d'où elles viennent, où elles vont aller. Alors, je crois que c'est tout que j'aimerais dire sur le programme maintenant pour situer un peu la chose. Maintenant, on va passer à Charlotte Bunch qui va présenter le féminisme international. Je peux dire beaucoup de choses sur Charlotte, c'est peut-être mieux qu'elle s'introduise elle-même. Mais ce serait en anglais maintenant, j'espère que tout le monde comprend l'anglais. S'il y a vraiment des problèmes, on peut faire des résumés ou bien des chuchotements. Est-ce que tout le monde...
Okay. Charlotte, you could just say a few words about who you are.
Okay.
There's also a chair over here if you want to sit. It's at least one. I must apologize that I cannot speak in French, so I will speak in English. I have been working originally in the women's movement in the United States for about 10 to 15 years as a feminist organizer and writer, and in the past 3 or 4 years specifically working on international networking among feminists in different parts of the world. And my interest in working on the international networking in many ways is not new. Like many of the feminists in the United States, I became a feminist in the context of the 1960s civil rights and anti-war movement, so that I feel that it's sort of a full circle for many of us as feminists who became politically aware in our own country through movements for social change, and specifically the context of the Vietnam War and an understanding of international imperialism and the United States' role in that, to then become feminists in our own country and then later want to come back again to look at what does it mean to be a feminist in a global context. So like many of the women that I work with, beginning now to explore in the last 4 or 5 years how to make connections as international feminists is, in a sense, returning to one of our roots of concern about the relationship of our movement to movements around the world. I want to say a few comments that you can ask me other questions about my own work in the United States or whatever when we have discussion. What I want to do today is to talk some about international feminism, or what I prefer to call global feminism, in terms of some of the concepts and ideas that I see emerging around the world and what those mean for a movement, and particularly for networking, which is the popular word these days, for how we cooperate with each other. Perhaps cooperation is just as good as networking, but networking is the term that people are using today. The first thing I want to say is that I prefer the term global, although I use both global and international. The reason that I prefer the term global is that it seems to me that as feminists, it is very important that we recognize that we are working of people among people rather than among nations, that very few of us represent the governments of our countries, and even when we do, I think that most feminists understand that an analysis of the world that is feminist must go beyond nationalism and national boundaries and must move beyond what I think has become one of the major forms of patriarchy in the world today, which is the nation-state complex and therefore the conflicts that are the wars, in essence, that are carried on in the name of nationalism, in the name of national security state, as we experience it in the West, in the United States in particular. The notion of national security has become a cover-up for militarism and for a police state in many countries. And so I think that in that sense I prefer global, although there's no perfect word. The important concept for me is not so much the word, but the concept that feminism moves beyond the national boundaries of any of our countries and seeks to create a world that also could move beyond those national boundaries, not just a feminist movement, but to affect the world so that nationalism, as it now represents, I think, to me it is sort of the largest scale logic of patriarchy, of the domination that begins of the man over the woman, that occurs in one race over another, that occurs in one culture over another, that is finally justified by one nation over another. And the other thing I want to say about global or international feminism is, as a way of working, is that I also think many of us have come to see that there are no issues, that there are very few issues anyway, that are simply limited to one nation. That most of the problems that women experience in the world, whether we like it or not, have become international or global problems. That if you are dealing with the problem of employment for women, whether you're dealing in industrial countries or in the, quotes, developing world, I don't know which phrase you've chosen to use at this conference. I have yet to find any set of phrases that are completely satisfactory. But that in both cases, the employment problems of women, the problems of women economically, are very tied to a transnational economy, to transnational corporations, to the control and manipulation of the economy at the global level. So that even today, women in the United States, for example, are finding it more difficult to unionize because what the transnational corporations are doing in the third world and the free trade zones is now being imported back into the United States, so that the way of manipulating the economy to say that women in any situation, and I say women, it's also men, but I think we all know that women are at a particularly low point in most of the transnational corporations' manipulation, that women in the United States are now finding that if they try to unionize, they are told that the factory will move to Mexico or Taiwan, just as women in Mexico and Taiwan are told if they try to unionize, the factory will move to some other country. So that we have an international cheap labor pool of women all over the world being manipulated. And I think it is only possible to counter that problem with global cooperation among women. And for example, some women in Mexico are doing an international Women Workers Bill of Rights to try to establish an international set of terms. All of us are not naive. We know that the workplace will not change simply by having a Bill of Rights. But to at least establish some terms of reference of what would be considered humane employment for women, and in so doing, I think, also affecting the question of employment of all people. Another example that is very much a part of my own work is in the area of sex tourism, trafficking in women, forced prostitution, which I have been working on, and it's very clear that you cannot attack that issue as an isolated national problem, that the condition of women in each country is affected by, once again, the global economy, but also by the way in which the condition of women traditionally is linked with the desire of the businesses that are setting up either forced prostitution or sex tourism to take advantage of women's traditional oppression in order to increase our situation of oppression. For example, at our workshop, a woman from India made a very good presentation of what happens to women who are trapped by forced marriages or dowry systems, and in trying to escape that, find that prostitution is the only other alternative they have to get away from their traditional oppression. And then, of course, once they're in forced prostitution, they become prey to the international gangs and businesses that are organizing trafficking in women. And you cannot approach that problem in isolation from what is happening to women in general. Sex tourism is even more obvious. I think most people know somewhat about the way that sex tourism has developed using the prostitution of women primarily in Southeast Asia, but it's also now beginning to be happening in Latin America to service the needs of men from rich countries, those being whether that's Western rich countries or Japanese or Saudi Arabian, wherever the money is and the men have the ability to buy the women. The other area that I would illustrate in terms of global consciousness, well, I think militarism is very clear, and militarism affects all women's lives. There are indications of what we know that in every situation where a military state or a military base from any country is established, the increase in rape, violence against women, battery of women in that area goes up immediately. So that there is a direct connection not only of prostitution, but of rape and battery of women in general. Wherever a military base is established, or when a military state is established, or as a woman presented a paper at our conference, in situations such as Latin America, where military state in Chile and Argentina then utilizes sexual torture as a form of political action against the women, so that you have the sexualization of women's oppression in the torture of political prisoners as well. These are just examples. I think the other example I use within the United States to talk about the importance of global cooperation is what has happened with contraception. And someone mentioned that yesterday at the workshop, the way in which the Western drug companies have used third world women as, quotes, guinea pigs for contraception, which indicates that if we are going to ever have control over our own health as women, we have to do it, again, in a global way. Women in the United States organized a lot to have certain forms of contraception banned within the United States, but because there was not a global consciousness, it was not for several years that we became aware that those contraceptives were then dumped, as they use the phrase, in third world countries. So that if we are going to have a global movement, we must organize together. We must know that they're going to be dumped and, for example, in that case, demand that contraceptions that are dangerous to women be destroyed, not just passed on to another part of the world. These, I think, are just some indications, and everyone here could talk about many other issues in terms of what it means to understand that the world is already global and that, therefore, feminists, to organize effectively, I think, have to have global consciousness. This does not mean that we organize internationally and ignore local problems. In my opinion, the only way to be effective globally is, in fact, to work very much at the local level, but to do, as a friend of mine calls it, to do global work, to do local work with a global consciousness. And I think that that's really what many of us are trying to create, is a sense of how to do our local work very much at the grassroots, which is where change must take place if it's going to be meaningful, but with a consciousness of the global interaction that already exists in the world. The other part of what I want to talk about is the other half of international or global feminism, which is feminism as a concept and a perspective on working in the world for change. Now, I could talk for many hours, and Jane and I were in a workshop in Bangkok in 1979 where we did spend about 3 days talking about feminism and what it meant globally, and I'm going to use reference to some of the things that we wrote from that workshop. But the thing that was most important to me in that workshop was that we discussed for a long time the ways in which the media has controlled and distorted the meaning of feminism within all of our countries as well as internationally. And particularly the way in which the Western-dominated mass media has chosen to ridicule and denigrate and distort feminism initially in the West, in part, I think, because they did recognize that feminism had the power to be very threatening to the system, the nation-state system. And so from the very beginning, they have chosen to ridicule, to downplay, and to take whatever small thing that occurs and to distort it entirely. And I hope in the course of today we will discuss some, what are those distortions and images of feminism that the media has given the world. But the two that seem to me, or the three that seem to me to be the most important, are one, to portray feminists as silly, as trivial, as sort of ridiculous, and to ridicule our efforts, and to take any one example, and I think the best example of that is what they did with the bra burning image, the bra burner, the image of the bra burner. I don't know if that's been exported to everywhere in the world. This image came from one demonstration out of about 300 in the United States in 1968 and 69. And the purpose of the one demonstration was not to get rid of bras, because women can wear them or not as they choose, but the purpose was to illustrate the way in which clothing constricts a woman's possibilities in life. And so there was one big trash can in which women threw anything they felt constricted them in their lives. Many women threw high heels, some women threw bras, some threw girdles, some threw makeup. And it was not meant to be a sort of statement that any of these things are the essence of our oppression, but rather to indicate that women are constricted by ordinary things like clothing. Well, most of you know what happened with that image, which is that it has been used to make trivial women's liberation, to say that it's just those bra burners, and to be totally separated from the political and social analysis that was behind even that action. Whether that action was that important is another question, but it was one of many. They did not choose to publicize the action of the same group of women who did things at the Department of Justice in the United States and called it the Department of Injustice, or at the CIA, or, you know, there were many other actions that they chose to ignore that were occurring in the same time. But I think that that's an illustration of how they try to take our political analysis and make it appear trivial and silly. Another way which they try to distort us, and I think this is occurring in other countries as well, but I'm using my own experience in the United States as reference point, is to label us anti-male and to say that we are all man-haters. Now, what they have done with this label is to, first of all, ignore the analysis feminists have made that the society is anti-woman, and that most of the focus of the women's movement has been not on anti-men, but on demonstrating the ways in which all our structures are anti-woman and how that occurs. But by taking this image and calling us man-haters, they have taken the focus off of and again trivialized the analysis of a woman-hating society and focused instead on, will we be just the same as the society has been and turn around and hate men? I think that the fact that some women probably hate men is true, but that that is not particularly relevant to what feminism has said. In fact, in my experience, the women who hate men are frequently not the feminists, because the feminists are at least doing something to change their lives in relation to men, and so they, if anything, are more positive in their interaction with men than many of the non-feminists I know, who feel so trapped by men that they do end up having that hatred. But this is not the way, of course, the label is used. And again, I think the label is used to make other women afraid that if you do something with the feminist, you must become a man-hater, and therefore to diffuse again the real political analysis of the feminist movement. The third image that I think in some ways is perhaps the most destructive is to characterize feminism, particularly in the West, as simply about women getting to be the top of General Motors or to become the president of the country or the prime minister. And to characterize feminism in that way, as a friend of mine has a slogan that I like, as simply add women and stir. To characterize feminism as simply adding a few women to the structures of society and stirring them in and moving them to the top. And I think that this is also a very destructive image, because clearly most women in society will not get much benefit from a few women rising to the top of any of our countries. And I think that most feminists do not understand feminism to mean a few women rising to the top. And yet in the United States you will find consistently the media will call any woman who gets to the top of some position of power a feminist and ask her what she thinks about feminism and ignore the movement, most of whom are women not involved in that kind of a move at all, most of whom are doing grassroots work on many different issues, maybe working in structures, some of whom are also trying to get elected to political office for the sake of change, a strategy which we could discuss, you know, whether that's a useful one or not. But that I think very few feminists actually see getting women to the top of power in the existing structures as the goal. And yet, by portraying this as the image of feminism, the media again attempts to make feminism irrelevant to as many women as possible. And in each one of these images, I think the effort is to keep women divided. The effort is to keep women feeling that whoever the feminists are, they are not you. So that, you know, each woman who hears about feminism will feel somehow that that's not who she is, and to keep, in that sense, trying to control our movement. The remarkable thing to me in the face of this kind of effort from the media consistently is that feminism has grown anyway. That women have grown feminism has grown all over the world in spite of the media's efforts to do these things, and that you have groups, and I think everyone here in the room could discuss different developments, groups continuing to identify with feminism, whether they call it feminism or not. In some cases, people have chosen not to call it feminism. And we could discuss what happens with the label. I think it really doesn't... I prefer to continue to call it feminism, because I think if you don't call it feminism, it doesn't make any difference. They will find another way to try to get to you. If you call it something else, then they will take a way to attack that label as well. I mean, the label is a tool for attack. I think it's... we could have a discussion of whether people want to work with different words, but I don't think it's the central question. The other thing I want to say about the media, and then I want to talk more about my own view of feminism, is that I think the media treats feminism in these ways, degrading it, trivializing it, and ridiculing it, much the same way that the societies treat women. That if you observe the way the media treats feminism, you are observing the way that the society views women, which is that the same attitudes of degrading us or ridiculing us or trying to make us appear not very serious about the real issues, the big things, is exactly what we experience as women in our societies, in the effort to make us feel that what we are saying is not as important as other things. Now, in the discussions that I mentioned about Bangkok, we talked a great deal about how do we have a understanding of feminism that counters some of these trends. And we came up with a way of defining feminism that is not perfect, but I think it's a useful reference point, in which we talked about the need to understand feminism as about basic transformational politics, basic change in society, transformational. You could say revolutionary. Again, I think it's another one of those words that has so many connotations in society, it's difficult. So we use the term transformational. But that is about seeking fundamental change in the structures of society as well as in many of the human values of the society. Changes that eliminate the oppression of women, but that also eliminate all forms of domination of one group by another. And that we saw the connection as very central between the elimination of women's oppression and the elimination of societies which are based on domination by one group of another. We focused on the two parts of that goal of feminism, by first and second, it doesn't mean a priority order, simply a list of one and two. The first, which we described as, and all of these are written also in the, this is also copied in the ISIS Women in Development book, so I can refer to you the pages. The first one, as the freedom from oppression for women involving not only equity or equality in the sense of equal rights, but also the right of women to freedom of choice and to the power to control our own lives both within and outside of the home, emphasizing that having control over our own lives, which includes our own bodies and our own sexuality, our own reproduction, our own development of our physical selves, is essential to ensuring a sense of dignity and autonomy for every woman. So that in this goal, we're really trying to focus on that area of the women's movement which has talked about the necessity for control over our own bodies and our own lives, the individual control of each woman to determine how she will be in society. The second goal is to address the social political structure part of our movement, which is the removal of all forms of inequity and oppression through the creation of a more just social and economic order nationally and internationally, which involves women in national liberation struggles, in plans for national development, and in other local and global strategies for change within their own countries, as well as throughout the world. Now, I think it's probably quite clear that what we were trying to do, in a sense, is what Marlene said yesterday when you were talking about Brazil, is to not allow the separation of the part of the women's movement that deals with our bodies and our sexuality from the part of the women's movement that addresses social, political, and economic structures. And to see that if feminism is to succeed, the two must go hand in hand. We can't separate these two tasks of the feminist movement, because the one is determined by the other. The political and social economic structures very much determine what happens to women individually. And also, we all know there can be social and political structures for change that do not give women individual freedom if there is not a movement concerned with women specifically and concerned with our own control of our bodies, because we have not yet experienced revolution for women that brought us that kind of control without that being a specific demand and movement within change. Now, each person's context, I'm sure, brings these two together in different forms, and that's part of our discussion. But the important thing for me is that we not allow ourselves to get separated from the two parts of feminism, to see them as always and continually interacting. The other thing for me is to see feminism in this way, is to see feminism as a perspective on the world, not what I sometimes call a laundry list of women's issues. That there is some tendency to, again, try to limit feminism by saying, well, feminism is about a certain laundry list, a certain limited number of issues. Feminism is about equal rights and reproductive freedom, and, you know, maybe women's health. But it's not about the control over the entire health system in the whole country, or it's not supposed to be about the economy or the workplace. I think that feminism today must demand very clearly that there is no issue that is not of concern to feminists. Because if feminism is a perspective on the world, we can bring that perspective to bear in looking at any concern and any issue. This is, I think, very important in not allowing our movement to be, again, segmented and divided by the notion that one issue is somehow appropriate to feminist activity and another is not. In Copenhagen, there was much discussion of the Copenhagen conference as, quotes, politicized. And many of us who were involved in Copenhagen kept trying to say the problem is not that it's politicized, because it should be political. Feminism is political. Feminism is itself political. But that it is politicized and dominated entirely by male definitions of politics. There was very little chance, or only in a few places, for women to define our own view of politics and our own view of approaching those issues. And I think that my own hope for any work we do in a place like the United Nations is that we are increasingly able to define a feminist approach to the, quotes, political issues, not that we ignore political issues in the world. And I also think it should come as no surprise, probably no one in this room is surprised, that a United Nations conference, which brings together 150 representatives of 150 nations that are all patriarchal and all dominate women, would not have a feminist view. And that our job is not so much to be surprised at that, but to try to continue to influence it with a clear feminist analysis of the issues that go on at the UN, as well as making sure that they consider new issues that are frequently not seen as political. Again, an example of a new issue. In the workshop that I was just in on traffic and women, and I have a press release from this workshop, I will give everybody a copy. One of the demands that we want to put on the international agenda is the demand that all women who are escaping forced prostitution, sex tourism, battered homes, whatever else, be seen as political refugees. Because only if women trying to escape violence against them, whether that's in the home or in prostitution or in a workplace condition, are seen as political refugees, will we begin to have a right to demand the resources of the so-called human rights community, most of which has so far defined human rights in very limited ways and not included many of what we consider to be the political crimes against women as human rights, begin to be seen as human rights issues. That only then will we begin to have the power of that kind of assistance to women that must take place if women are individually to escape these conditions, but also structurally and together to begin to redefine what is political, what is seen as political in the world. Now, the other thing I want to say is that I see feminism in this sense as a transformational politics, as fundamental change, which is also a politics for men. I do not believe that feminism is for women only. I believe that feminism is a new political approach to society that men should be pushed to also begin to incorporate in their politics. And to me, that is the more important answer to the label of man-hater than responding on that level. It's to say that the politics of feminism is a way of viewing the world which is for all people, and that men can also begin to incorporate that into their politics. In so doing, I am not saying that we will never agree with or utilize political ideas that have been developed outside of feminism. I think there are many, many cases. There are very good political ideas feminism will ally with in different situations, but that it is itself an idea and a force and a movement that is very strong and should be seen as such and not seen, as I think has happened in many cases, as a, quote, constituency of women. And by seeing us as a constituency of women, there is again an attempt to reduce what we are saying to simply another special interest. There is this constituency and that constituency, and each has its special interest. And rather than our demands being universally important, they are only to compete with another group of special interests. And I think that as we define politics of feminism as fundamental to society, we are also more able to counter this notion of just a special interest constituency. There are still occasions when women must be organized as a special constituency for practical purposes. I'm not saying we don't organize women. We must organize women. But the politics is not limited to that organization. It goes beyond just a constituency. I know I'm saying a lot of things very fast, but hopefully we'll have time. You can question these ideas and we can talk about them in the afternoon. The consequence of this way of looking at feminism and looking at it globally for me is that feminists are today in a position in many parts of the world to begin to challenge other ideas in society from a feminist view. I have mentioned, for example, militarism. I think that feminists and many women are active in the peace movement in different ways. I think that feminists can bring to the question of militarism not just women for peace in the old sense, but a very specific analysis of violence in society as women have come to understand it in the movements of women against violence against women, the movements that have analyzed rape and pornography and wife battery and sexual mutilation and sexual harassment in the workplace, are able to bring that analysis to looking at militarism, to see that there is, in fact, a very basic mode of being in our societies about violence and domination, that when it occurs on the individual basis, my best example of this is if you bring up a child from a very small age in a home where both the child and the woman are constantly battered and abused, as we find many, many children as well as mothers are, it should be no surprise that that child, whether it's a man or a woman, as an adult, accepts militarism, accepts the idea that violence is a solution to problems, accepts violence as inevitable, because that is the mode that most of our societies exist in, where children see violence as a very crucial part of daily life. And I don't believe that we will be able to stop militarism. And by militarism, I don't mean struggle for national liberation. I mean militarism as a mode of being, a military state, a sort of whole way of life. I don't think we can do those struggles without seeing that base. I don't think we will succeed. I don't think we'll be able to change militarism or nuclear weapons or any of the rest of that unless you get at the crucial beginning of violence as a method of solving problems and at the injustices in the world that method has covered up. And so I think feminists have a particularly important way of bringing those questions to focus that is different than what we knew 20 years ago as a peace movement. I think the same is true in other areas. I look at the issues of the work conditions of women's lives. And I think that if you begin to examine what happens in the free trade zones, for example, as one of the worst examples of women's working conditions, where women's eyesight is destroyed in a very few years for the multinational corporations. Again, you see the central essence of the question of what is the right of any worker to have control over her or his body and her life if you can be destroyed in a few years for the sake of a multinational corporation. And you begin to define again another way of looking at the rights of workers in society and of course, questioning the corporations and capitalism with a feminist view of what work conditions must be if we are going to try to change the society. I won't go on into more examples. I think that each of you could take any set of issues you're working on and make the same connections of what feminists are doing in specific feminist work and how it is linked to the broader issues in society as a feminist. The other thing that I think is important is to look at some of the problems that arise from an isolated approach. If we take feminism in isolation, if we don't see it as a part of a whole transformation, then I think there are certain problems that we have to deal with that become almost impossible to solve in an isolated way. For example, the issue of cultural diversity. I think many of us have faced the issue in our own societies as well as globally of how to value cultural differences, of how to maintain cultural differences. In the United States, this is in part how to counter the, quotes, melting pot ethic of the United States, which is based on the idea that all cultural groups will become similar and will lose their own distinctive characteristics, ways of living, and so forth. Our position as feminists is that we want to maintain cultural diversity, that cultural diversity is, in fact, creative, that everyone should not have to come and fall into one model in the United States, one American middle-class way of living, which is not the way people live, most of the people live anyway, but is the model we're all supposed to live up to. Now, what I feel happens when we look at cultural diversity is unless we are clear about feminism, we allow other people to use cultural diversity as an excuse for women's oppression. And that what we have to say is that cultural diversity is not incompatible with eliminating women's oppression. That the parts of cultural change that we want to make in every culture, including the industrialized world, where women's oppression, I think, is very acutely tied to cultural forms, is to change all of that part which is oppressive to women and to allow that part which is creative diversity to continue. And we talk, I think, in many situations, we have allowed ourselves to be intimidated by the argument that changing women's oppression is to attack the culture, rather than to say the culture, to be creative and dynamic, must survive without oppressing anyone. And it must therefore change not to become like any one model, because certainly the Western industrial model for women is not liberation. If there's nothing else I could say today, it is that the Western industrial model of women's role is not a model for liberation of women. So every single one of us must find a model for liberation that is separate from how our culture now defines women's roles. and yet bringing whatever we feel is positive from our cultures into that. So we will have many diverse models, I think. But none of them, I think, can be justified. Oppression can never be justified. Slavery was a very big part of the culture of Greece. But I hope no one argues today that slavery is okay because it was part of the Greek culture. And I think that in the same way in the United States in the South, you know, discrimination and segregation against black people was very much a part of the culture. But the civil rights movement did not accept that that segregation of black people was okay because it was cultural. And it was a very strong part of the culture, but it was still oppression. And it was not to be justified. There are aspects of that culture, as with Greek culture or any other, that are valuable, that can be retained, but without the aspect of oppressing any group. And I think women have to be much bolder about the fact that our oppression is just as bad as the oppression of slaves or of any other group and cannot be justified for cultural reasons. But, as I said, the only way for me to do that is to recognize that there is no culture in existence that has liberated women. So we are not saying everyone must become alike, but rather each culture is struggling to find what is a form for freedom and liberation of women within the context of what we come from. I think that the other problem of seeing the interrelatedness deals with another problem that we have, which is the differences among us as women. Some of those differences are cultural. Some of those differences are also based on race. They're based on sexuality and our sexual preference. They're based on the kinds of families and religions we come from. And those differences, it seems to me, again, the differences themselves can be celebrated. We do not all have to be alike. We do not all have to love the same people. We don't all have to wear the same clothes. We don't all have to live in the same kinds of families or anything else. But that what we do have to achieve is a situation where none of us, because of those differences, is allowed to dominate or oppress the other.